Chapter 39. Davin's mind slipped in and out of a sleepy haze, his eyes never quite able to focus before they closed again in profound slumber. Blurs of light followed blurs of dark, like the white flame and the dark shape that had danced around it, each taking turns in his fuzzy consciousness. The first concrete recollection he had was of being trapped, something on top and to the sides of him, keeping his shivering body from moving. During his next brief sojourn of wakefulness, it was light again, and he found that the confining weight on top of him was a pile of fur blankets. Drifting into consciousness of the outside world, mingled with dreams both comforting and terrifying when he drifted out again. His slumbering visions, a repeat of his experience at the Seeing Wall. In those dreams, he would caress Ariane's face. Then he would watch the executioner lower her into the water, trapped in a cage and drowned in the cloud river that ran near Belshire. When his eyes finally snapped open for good, he waited for a moment for his thoughts and his vision to clear. His body felt warm, but sapped of its strength, like the morning he had awoken after the sabercat attack. A famished body demanded satisfaction, his stomach churning with hunger. Otherwise, he was intact, though confused about what exactly had happened to him after the Seeing Wall had pushed him out of its icy embrace. He exhaled and stirred, pushing off the furs until he noticed his nakedness. Kian Tar sat at the entrance to the hide-covered dwelling where someone had laid him to recover. They glanced up from little rings they were carving out of bone and smiled in unison.
"The brown man awakes," Ki exclaimed. "You must call him Kodokim, sister," Tar admonished. "I gave him of my heat so that he wouldn't die, so I shall call him whatever I wish until he repays the debt," Ki answered. "Go get him some food and tell father he is awake. I will give him drink and get him dressed."
Tar put her carving down and strode out. Ki was using his carving knife and noticed him spying it.
"Don't worry, brown man, I will give it back. I simply wanted to try it to see if it might aid my craft."
She put the knife back in the carving bag, crossed to a bucket near the tent flap, and dipped the ladle in it. After kneeling at his side, she offered the ladle to him.
"Drink, brown man, food is coming."
He drank it quickly, and downed two more ladles full before he was finished.
"How long is it since I returned from the Seeing Wall?" he asked.
2 days and 2 nights, she said,
pulling his clothes out from under the furs at the foot of his bed. They had been cleaned and mended.
"This is the start of the 3rd day.
She tossed him the clothes and regarded him speculatively, hands on her hips.
"How do you feel?"
"Weak and hungry."
"Would you mind turning around, please?"
Her eyes rolled up and she turned.
"My sister and I had to warm you to keep you from dying, brown man. Your body holds no secrets for us."
They had warmed him. He cleared his throat.
"I thank you for the courtesy all the same, Ki."
"I am Tar," she lied. "You are Ki," he answered.
She half turned and Davin barked a warning as he hadn't so much as lifted his pants.
"You can't tell us apart," she exclaimed.
"Well, it is only by the design around your navel that I can do so, nothing more."
"Very good, brown man," she said. "No other man has divined that little secret yet. You are more clever than you look."
"Well, I'm sure someone observant will come along, but if you were more modestly dressed, I would be as lost as everyone else."
It was a subtle suggestion that didn't seem to register to her Awakatan mind.
"So tell me about this woman, Ariane. She's the one you wish to bond, yes?"
"Well, she and I are... well, it is difficult to explain," Ki snorted.
"Is she brown like you are? Like us?"
"Her skin is pale, though her hair is as black as the night."
"And from your ramblings, you fear she is in some danger?"
"Yes, I must depart as soon as I am able. But do your people think I am Kodokim now?"
She turned, mouth agape.
"Think you are Kodokim? How can you say that? You are Kodokim. My father, the Akor, and the other Kai saw you in beast form. You are the Tamal Lukan of the primal beast. You have the gift."
He was halfway up the buttons of his shirt and stopped.
"Beast form?" "Yes, ridiculous man, beast form.
Come outside. Come on.
Davin finished the buttons on his shirt and retrieved his knife and carving bag. Outside the tent, the sun was bright, warm morning rays infusing him with a little spark. Jujal's family dwellings appeared deserted, save for the two of them. Ki turned, planting her feet and folding her arms.
Now change, she instructed.
Change? How? He asked.
How should I know? She said, sounding a little disgusted. You are the Kodokim. How did you first change?
I don't remember it clearly. I pushed into the wall because I saw Ariane in danger. I was furious, desperate. His emotions rose at the memory, and then it happened. His body, his clothes, his carving bag, everything connected to him swirled together into a gigantic mass of a saber cat. Ki yelped and then covered her mouth in amazement before dropping her arms and smiling at him. She walked forward, tentatively. Davin tried to talk, but it came out as bestial grunts. While he still felt weak, the body he inhabited held unimaginable physical power. As Ki approached, he realized just how big he was. He looked her in the eye as she reached out and ran her fingers through the snow-white fur along his neck, face astonished.
You are magnificent, she said reverently, stepping back. Now, roar to the sky! Announce to the world that Kodokim has come!
At first, the idea seemed strange, but something inside him was building, a thrill he had never felt before. The knowledge of what he could do and the power of the body he now possessed poured a confidence into him that could not be restrained. Sucking the clear mountain air into his massive lungs, he let loose a yell so deep and primal that it shook the very earth around their feet. Ki fell to the ground and covered her ears, the long blast reverberating through the mountain valley. Dazed, Ki stood.
I have never heard anything.
In moments, Jujal and Tar ran into the clearing in front of the dwellings and joined in the amazement, approaching him cautiously. Davin calmed himself and concentrated, which returned him to his human form. Everyone relaxed. Legs unsteady, Davin sat at one of the rough-hewn benches near the smouldering fire pit. Jujal signaled Tar forward, and she handed Davin a sack of bitter dried berries and a slab of cold roasted meat.
You had us worried on the mountain, Jujal said. Once you collapsed and returned to human form, we couldn't find the beating of your heart for some time. The Acor thought you dead.
He probably wished me dead, Davin thought. A question came to Davin's mind, something that had bothered him from the moment he awoke. Jujal, you took the test at the Seeing Wall when you became the Tamalu Khan of Primal Air, correct?
Yes. I am the only one who has taken the test in over 30 years.
What is the dark shadow that dances around the light? Jujal's face wrinkled.
Shadow?
Yes, it danced around the light as if to block or extinguish it.
I saw no such thing. Only the light.
Davin explained what he had seen, but Jujal just shook his head.
That is a new thing, Kodokim. It is not recorded in our lore anywhere. It troubles me. I will bring your report to the Kai. I expect they will be here soon after that roar.
Davin tore a piece of meat and devoured it. What's the Acor going to do with me now? Not that Davin cared. One way or another, he would leave through that crack in the mountainside and make for Belshire.
He is in an uncomfortable position, Jujal said,
as more people poured into the clearing, drawn by the roar of Kodokim. Jujal lowered his voice.
He cannot command you, but he fears that you will do the Aur Katan harm. Bring more of your people here. He already fears the influence you have had.
Davin nodded, understanding. The Acor feared the corruption and discovery of his people more than any other danger. From what Davin knew, Kritis had all but eradicated the Aur Katan, fearing their belief and worship of the primal forces. If Davin could reassure the Acor that he meant them no harm and wished them well in their way of life, perhaps he could leave Jonkal with his blessing. Before long, a veritable host of Aur Katan had arrived and watched him eat breakfast, no doubt waiting for him to transform into the beast and favour them with a mighty bellow. The food and drink fortified him. As he licked the grease from his fingers, the Acor strode into view, his bone-carving necklaces swaying back and forth around his neck with his vigorous stride.
Kodokim,
he said, though Davin could see it cost him pain to apply that appellation to an outsider.
I have come to ask you what you intend to do, serve yourself or the needs of this people?
Neither, he said. The people of my nation are in grave peril from traitors. It is them I serve. Key stepped forward.
And the woman he wishes to bond is in grave danger as well.
The Acor waved her off.
Be that as it may, he is now bound to the Ahuakatan people. We have need of the Kodokim.
Davin stared up at the Acor, finding his plaintive note odd.
What need do you have?
As Kodokim, you can find the primal forces. You can bring them here to our people.
To what end? Davin asked.
We are not strong. While your people are content to ignore us, those of Cretus hunt and destroy us when they can. We have seen them in great numbers in the mountains of late, and fear they may have come to destroy us and our sacred home.
Cretesians in the mountains? Davin asked, perplexed. Here in the north? Are you sure?
I have seen them, Key said, in numbers. They first came in the autumn last year. Even more came this spring.
Davin stood.
What are they doing?
Key shrugged.
I do not know. What I saw were small groups based in larger encampments to the east, scouting perhaps.
Davin paced for a moment. Why would the Cretesians bother with the mountains? It was nearly impossible to get an army through them. They had always amassed in the south when they wanted to do a little saber-rattling. Still, a camp and some scouts hardly seemed evidence of a serious threat, though it was curious.
Acor, Davin said, I must go, but when this is over, I promise I will return and help you when I am sure my country and my people are safe.
And that his woman is safe, Key added helpfully. Ta and I will go with him to ensure he keeps his promise.
That isn't necessary, Davin said. I am a man of my word and will return if I am able.
We go, Ta said. There is no argument. We can either accompany you or follow you.
You must understand that I will go as fast as I can. I will ride, I will run, I will not stop.
And we will follow, Ta and Key said together.
The Acor didn't seem happy, but he had no power and knew it.
Then go and be done quickly, he finally said. And do not forget our need.
Ariane rubbed the back of her neck, muscles wrenching into knots and radiating a dull, pounding ache into the back of her skull. Sitting for 2 days in court, watching a fountain of lies and speculation about her involvement in dark conspiracies, had marched her through a gauntlet of sharp and bitter emotions. To have her character and reputation bullied and beaten filled her with indignation. Sitting helplessly by during the beating turned that indignation into exhaustion and despair. Mr. Red, her dutiful lawyer, argued and grandstanded until even she grew weary of it, and now, as she sat waiting for the last witness, she knew the trial had long since ended. Even she could see that the critical evidence against her had no convincing refutation anyone could offer. Her husband and his treasonous affairs had killed her just as surely as Davin Carver had killed him. As her case deteriorated, she felt more and more abandoned. Her parents refused to attend, probably not wishing to be sullied by their daughter's downfall. They had at least let Elaine visit her after the first day. The young girl sobbed in her arms, more than once expressing her wish that Baron Carver would come. Ariane shared that wish but didn't vocalize it, and the more scared she became, the more angry she was with the man. How dare he abandon her in this hour of need? She knew these thoughts weren't fair, but they came anyway. The Queen had come yesterday evening and condoled with her, and the monarch's tears of sympathy truly shook Ariane to the core. She had never seen the Queen cry. She might expect a stone to cry first. And if Philippa was crying, then Ariane knew her situation was dire indeed. The Queen could not override the judgment of the court for capital crimes, and nothing, it seemed, but some unseen providence could provide an escape now. Mr. Gutke, the head prosecutor, rose from his seat and approached the bench. He was a hale, youthful man with a powerful voice, one Ariane was sick to death of.
We would like to call Mr. Edward Cranton, former head clerk to the High Tower Estate. We ask for special consideration of this witness, as he was recently wounded in an assassination attempt.
Ariane had heard the ill news just before the first day of the trial. When she learned that the man would testify in person, her heart had sunk. She knew how his testimony would play out. Lady Hightower arrives in town one day,
and the next an assassin tries to kill off her steward and her clerk.
It looks bad, Mr. Red had said, but there is no evidence to connect you to the assassin.
Still, her steward was dead, and besides herself, there would be few that would want either of them dead. Baron Carver was likely one of them, but she doubted that he was involved. If he had pulled the trigger, her clerk would be dead too. Whoever the assassin was, and whatever his motives, he had ended sloppily without finishing the job. Even so, Mr. Red said it wouldn't have mattered factually if the two were alive or dead. Their testimony had been recorded some time ago.
The attack only muddied the water a bit,
he prevaricated, when she asked what such an event would do to her chances of winning the trial. She knew very well that the assassination attempt would clear the water in the mind of the judge. The bailiff led Mr. Cranton in from a side room, the screeching of the dark wooden door cutting through the murmuring and paper shuffling of the courtroom. The dismal interior where the drama played out consisted of dark wood panelling running all the way up to the high ceiling. Windows sat atop the wall running all the way around the octagonal room. Judge Pinkerton sat behind a large, raised desk, evidence laid about him. A single stand sat directly in front of him, where witnesses stood or sat to deliver their testimony. Whether an act or not, Mr. Cranton made a great deal of piteous moaning as he ascended the three steps to the witness stand. His coat was off and his arm in a sling, a slight stain of red blushing the white linen that covered his wound. Mr. Red leaned in.
A fine piece of showmanship, he whispered. He is trying to gain the sympathy of the judge and seem vulnerable.
While her lawyer might enjoy a cold analysis of tactics, she was furious. Mr. Red had warned her not to look angry and sullen, as it would only prejudice the judge against her, but with her case as good as lost, it hardly seemed to matter now. She would scowl all she wanted. If she had a chance, she thought she might just see how well Mr. Cranton's head would fare against the thick book of law hulking on the table next to her left elbow. After introductions, Mr. Gutke launched into a line of questioning about how the late Lord Cornton of Hightower had indicated that a certain amount of funds be dispersed to one Justice Page of Longford on a monthly basis, and how upon his death the Lady of Hightower had asked that the payments continue. Ariane knew her face had turned blood red, and she wanted to scream, "Liar!" until the hall rang with it. He continued with the confrontation at Hightower during Davin's visit, fabricating an entire narrative about how she strictly ordered them to destroy the ledgers and tell no one or she would kill them. He claimed that he and the steward had hired a man to recover them, but that Davin Carver had killed him, thinking him a robber. At that point she felt it best to lean back and stop listening, choosing instead to come up with a list of angry, cutting phrases to level at one absent Davin Carver, should he have the decency to show up before they marched her off to the drowning bridge.
"And relate to us the events of 4 nights ago, if you please, Mr. Cranton," Mr. Gutke prompted.
Mr. Cranton leaned back, wincing.
"I was in the protective custody of the sheriff at Blacklock Prison. 4 nights ago, I was dead asleep in my chambers when a shot rang out, startling me from sleep. I couldn't know at the time that—"
Mr. Cranton stopped, emotion welling up in his voice. Ariane wondered if it was sincere. He continued.
"I couldn't know at the time that the horrible assassin had killed my colleague and long-time friend, Mr. Barles."
"Please, continue,"
Mr. Gutke said after allowing several moments for Mr. Cranton to collect himself.
"I stood from my bed when my chamber door was thrown open."
"And who did you see?"
"I could see nothing," Mr. Cranton explained. "A lantern shone in my face, and my eyes were blinded. The man at the door said, 'Lady Hightower sends her regards,' and then he shot me and left me for dead. I heard him run away."
Murmuring erupted among the spectators, whispers of conjecture and outrage blooming about Ariane as she sat, staring daggers at Mr. Cranton's profile. He was genuinely scared, she decided. He might be part of the scheme, but he probably thought his position in it so low that he would attract no dangerous notice. The judge banged the gavel for order.
"Proceed, Mr. Gutke."
"Very well. Mr. Cranton, do you believe that Lady Hightower sent the man to kill you?"
Mr. Red raised his hand.
"Objection! What the witness believes is not relevant. I remind the court that we are after facts, not opinions."
"Sustained,"
the judge said.
Mr. Gutke turned to face Mr. Red. "Very well. I surrender the witness for cross-examination."
Mr. Red stood, pacing back and forth in front of the witness for several long moments, Mr. Cranton's head following him back and forth as if on a swivel. The judge opened his mouth, but Mr. Red dove in before the magistrate could admonish him for his obviously calculated delay.
Mr. Cranton, you testified that Lady Hightower threatened you and Mr. Barles, telling you to destroy the ledgers and threatening you with death. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Cranton confirmed.
And that you then hired a man to retrieve them?
Yes.
Mr. Red nodded.
And was this man a part of the sheriff's office in Longford?
No, sir.
And why did you not seek out the sheriff to deal with these allegations, instead of hiring a Mr. Aberforth, a well-known drunk and ruffian?
Little rivulets of sweat dripped down Mr. Cranton's forehead, his skin blanching. For the first time in the entire trial, Ariane felt a glimmer of hope.
We were afraid that the sheriff would not take our plea seriously as the matter dealt with the lady and landholder of the town. By the time we had formulated our plan, it was well after dark, and Mr. Aberforth was ready and willing to do the job. We bade him quite strictly not to hurt anyone.
Mr. Red nodded.
And how much did you pay for his service?
£5.
The crowd murmured again, and Mr. Red let it play.
So little? For a matter of such importance? Or were you merely playing the part of a good clerk and saving a little money?
Honestly, Mr. Cranton answered, we had no idea why the ledgers were so important at this point. We were merely transferring money. When the lady became violent and threatening, we knew that saving the ledgers would help us prove our case. But we had no notion of it ever being involved in some treasonous plot.
I see, Mr. Red said.
And could you explain why Lady Ariane Hightower didn't just burn the ledgers herself? Why would she entrust them to David Harper, or Baron Carver, as we know now?
Objection, Mr. Gutke popped in. Mr. Cranton cannot speak to what Lady Ariane's motives were. We shall have to await her testimony for that.
Sustained.
Very well, Mr. Red said.
Then I will ask you this. Before the incident with the ledgers, had Lady Hightower ever threatened you or anyone else with violence, to your knowledge?
Irrelevant, Mr. Gutke interrupted.
Overruled, the judge said. It speaks to the lady's character. Answer the question.
The pale Mr. Cranton chewed on this question for some time, screwing up his face into a great mask of concentration.
Not that I can recall, he finally said.
Did she ever maltreat or abuse you while under her employ?
No.
And did you ever question Lord Caunton of Hightower or the Lady Ariane Hightower about the prodigious amount of money being funneled away from their estate?
No.
Mr. Red stopped his pacing and turned his head toward Mr. Cranton.
Never once?
I did not. It was not my place to question.
And would you personally hire the courier to take the money to Longford?
Customarily, yes, though Mr. Barles would do it when I could not.
Silence hung in the air, Mr. Red gradually approaching the witness stand, his eyes boring into Mr. Cranton's.
Now, Mr. Cranton, be very careful about how you answer this next question. What if I were to tell you that the personal finances of your household had been looked over, and that it was found that you had been socking away a little extra money from an unknown source. What would you say then?
Mr. Cranton sweat rivers now, his skin paling to a corpse-like hue, sickly and grey. His slack mouth twitched up and down in search of something to say. Ariane watched carefully as Mr. Gutke was yelling objection and screaming at the judge to censure Mr. Red, who calmly watched the stunned witness.
Do not answer the question, Mr. Gutke instructed his charge.
The judge pounded the gavel until silence fell.
Mr. Red, do you have evidence concerning Mr. Cranton's finances that you wish to present to the court?
Just the witness's terrified demeanour, he said. I am through with him.
Mr. Gutke's face boiled red, but he held his tongue. The judge turned to the prosecutor.
Do you have any further witnesses to call, Mr. Gutke?
Just one, Your Honour.
I would like to call Lady Ariane Hightower to the stand.